Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, May 1st, 2012, and I'm your host, Anastasia, filling in while Lavendar, Ariel, and Sierra are on the Sacred France Starseed Quest. I want to thank Sahar for hosting the switchboard tonight, and while we won't be having live questions during this show, the call-in number for listening is 917-889-8292. And if you like our show, remember to click follow on our show page and tell a friend about us. For our new listeners, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. We'll get started in just a moment, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. Our Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings, and you can find out if you have star markings and how they determine your natural state and rites of passage with a Stage 1 reading based on your natal astrological chart. Our Stage 2 sessions are a one-on-one phone consultation, a reading with one of our gifted seers. We also offer a Stage 4 support service with Sierra for contactees and abductees, so check out Sierra's World on our main site. Now, while Lavendar, Ariel, and Sierra are away in France for the next 3 weeks, I've remained behind to be available for any Stage 2 reading needs that you might have. Just give me a call at 888-881-0881 or go to the StarseedHotline.com website and click on Anastasia's World. I'm honored to be of clairvoyant assistance to you when you need insight into your life, so give me a call. Okay. You know that our mission on Starseed Radio Academy is to examine the nature of reality from as many different perspectives as possible. We've heard from many guests on this program, and they've all given us their ideas about what may be. Tonight's guest is going to help us stretch a little bit more. His story has baffled and perplexed researchers, psychologists, scientists, and even other contactees who have gathered at conferences and elsewhere to hear his story. Now, long before the term UFO was even invented, this man was interacting with a vast array of non-humans and high strangeness. At times traumatic, and at other times so profoundly beautiful that it still brings tears to his eyes, his lifelong contact experiences cover a broad and enigmatic dimension of a phenomenon that continues to defy understanding. And now, he has published a trilogy of books outlining his more than 70 years of contact with high strangeness, and he's agreed to join with us tonight to share his story. Our guest tonight is John Foster, author, artist, former engineer, and lifetime contactee. He is the author of Imminent Discovery, The Imminent Discovery Book of Illustrations, and To Earth from Heaven. You can find John's website at fosterufos.com. Now, Starseed listeners, it's time to welcome tonight's guest, John Foster, to our program. Hello, John. Welcome to tonight's show.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you. I know that I'm excited about interviewing you and discussing your encounters and the things that you've learned over a lifetime of contactee experiences. And, John, I have to tell you that it's like eating a wonderful pie. I want to take in the whole thing all at once. We have to start somewhere. So I have told the audience a little bit about you, John, and that you have written two books as a contactee over many decades of your life. The first book called Imminent Discovery, and then a book that goes along with that, Imminent Discovery, an illustrated picture book that's just full of these wonderful illustrations that you've done detailing your UFO encounters. It's just absolutely fascinating. In fact, there's a craft here that I have seen, and I'm encouraging our Starseed to get a hold of this book. Look at these pictures. Perhaps it will trigger some memories of your own. And the second book is It's To Earth From Heaven. It is a take on sort of the spiritual, metaphysical, deeper meaning aspects of his UFO encounters. And all three of these books are available at John's website, fosterufos.com. I want to tell the audience that you and I met each other tangentially back in 1993 at the Rocky Mountain UFO Conference in Laramie, Wyoming. And John has actually given many talks. He's been a feature guest on many radio shows. He's given many lectures. He's gone to many conferences and shared his story with many people. And John, let's start out by talking about your beginning experiences. You had mentioned in your books that you started out your life in a normal way. And then when you were 49, some interesting things happened to you.
Yeah, just before I was 49, I was actually 48 in spring of 1986. Actually, I probably should say that I considered myself normal most of my life, except that I had experienced a few very strange things. One was seeing brilliant lights and hearing odd sounds at my bedroom window when I was about 2 or 3 years old, and some other things. And then when I was 18, I believe, it was 1956, I was rounding up the horses at a logging camp for work on Monday morning, and I saw a brilliant light, and I had a lost kind, and that was a very frightening experience, you might say. And that actually begins at chapter one of the first book. Anyway, in 1986 then, I had developed an interest in seeing a UFO. Actually, I should say before that, in 1981, my son-in-law and I said a prayer that we might be able to see a UFO. And about 3 minutes later, a glowing orange disc flew right over our head. And what was kind of strange about that is it kind of tips me, you know, like an airplane would tip in recognition. That it was like God was saying, you're welcome, you know, here's the answer to your prayer.
Let's back up just a little bit. Let's tell the audience a little bit about your normal life. You were trained as a fluidics engineer, John?
Well, actually, I have 4.5 years of college with no degree. I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, but President Eisenhower had set a quota for America to produce more engineers, and I was kind of guided in that direction. And the first solid job was at Hallam Nuclear Plant near Lincoln, Nebraska, where I live. And that I started as a junior engineer, and then I kind of progressed from there and went to California and did some other engineering. And I was basically in research and development. And then I went into fluidics, which is a science. It's a sister to electronics. And then Annie and I began to look for a place where we could really settle, and that happened to be back home in Lincoln. I was a native of Lincoln, and so we moved back here, and I went into alarm systems for a couple companies here. And then I dropped out of engineering and was a home builder for a while.
So you just pretty much lived a normal life up until you began to wonder about UFOs, ask to see them. Was there anything significant that triggered that interest, John?
Yeah, well, I was outside on the patio one night, and I had just a really strange feeling, and I saw the reflection of the city lights on the clouds through the trees, and it was late winter, 1986, and I had heard that some people had a UFO encounter but didn't remember until they were hypnotized. And so I tried to remember a time when I might have seen another UFO. And by golly, a picture flashed in my mind's eye, and I instantly knew that it was real, and I began to remember when it happened. Well, I told Annie when I had that memory that I did see another UFO after all, you know. And she really wasn't interested. She says, oh, yeah, you did. You know, it was like, no big deal. And for me, I thought that being an engineer, I thought that was just a tremendous thing, that if we could understand and know that UFOs actually existed, that it would help humankind tremendously. We would get into a new era or a new paradigm of thinking, you might say. As we go on with the story, you'll find out that I was somewhat educated and conditioned my entire life to perform, to do certain things, especially later in life. It's just a fantastic, unbelievable story, but I have witnesses that help verify it.
We're going to get into some of that tonight, but this was you have had a purpose-directed life, no doubt. And so, and I do want to get into some of this encounters that you've had. Everyone's eager to hear about it. So, but now you have children. You have how many children, John?
I have three children, yeah, and we do have grandchildren.
And back when all this started happening, it was a normal family life, but when your memories started coming back, it shook your world, didn't it, John?
It took me several months to recall everything that happened the night of that first memory. It was at the Bethany Grade School playground in Lincoln, and there were 30 people present at the time. I would have been around 13 years old. It would have been sometime near 1950.
Can you give us a brief overview of this conscious memory that returned to you? What happened at the Bethany School? What did you see that night that you were able to consciously remember over a period of months?
Okay, now remember that everyone saw what I saw, except when I was levitated into the craft. But basically, the craft showed up, and the crowd was mesmerized by what it saw because the lights were so strange. And they approached us from about four blocks away. There were a few things that happened that were very strange. Like, this was as the sun was going down, and we had all showed up at the playground for an outdoor movie, which was typical back in those days because people didn't have money to go downtown and to the regular theater.
It was a community movie, and a whole crowd of people showed up. The sun was going down, and then you all saw a light in the sky approaching.
Actually, no, it was just above the treetops, and it was kind of moving back and forth, and the lights would blink, and there was a strange blue light that we later saw that was revolving around the bottom of the craft. And it looked like an electric corona. And at any rate, it approached us within, I would say, 100 feet. And then it left, and then it returned. And when it returned, it was very close, hovering above the trees right near us. And there was kind of a radiation that came out of the craft. And the atmosphere looked sort of blue. And I began to feel real strange and began to notice that the entire crowd was becoming paralyzed. And at any rate, a few things happened. It swooped down and it landed in a lot right across the street. It was an empty lot. And three little guys got out and they kind of huddled on the ground.
Three little guys got out. Now, that's just mind-blowing. Now, let's just stop for a minute. Here, a craft of unusual... It wasn't a helicopter. This was something no one had ever seen before. People were paralyzed. People were paralyzed around you. It came down and landed, and three little men came out. What did these little men look like?
Well, one was looked very human with a head of hair. One was had a bald head. And the other had a bald head, and he was more, you might say, skinny and gangly. Well, now, this is a very complex story. Scientifically, it's extremely complex also. So I'll just tell you at this time, when we were standing across the street looking at them, it looked like they were two and a half to 3 foot tall, okay? Now, there were people in the crowd that would mention or exclaim, it's a helicopter. And somebody else would say, no, it's not. It looks like a spacecraft or something like that. So there were all kinds of comments being made, and we knew that it wasn't anything that we had seen on Earth before. At any rate, they went under the craft and went through motions as if to fix it, and then they went back inside. Well, here's one thing to keep in mind as the story goes on, is that I ran over to the street to get a better look at it at one point, and it was like looking through a magnifying glass, and the craft got bigger, and then it was back to a normal size. So there was a distortion of the atmosphere that made it look bigger, okay? And then we're finding out nowadays that discoveries that sort of support the phenomena that people like me witnessed during the encounters. The experimentation in Europe, for instance, with the accelerator, there are, I've heard some of the scientists interviewed, and they are talking about other dimensions and that are beyond what we see and feel. Well, at any rate, at one point, I began to feel and hear this voice, and I need to say feel, and I felt and heard it. And it was a message that said, go to the craft, go to the craft, go to the craft. And it was irresistible. And the crowd hadn't let me through or even to take a good look at it. They lined up on an embankment. And this feeling was so strong, I just ran towards them and I just pushed them aside. And I walked down the embankment and started to head for the craft. And a couple of the fathers yelled at me to come back, you know, that they didn't know who they were or where they came from, and I could be carried away possibly. And this feeling was so strong, I just kept going, and I stopped about 15 foot in front of it, and it was a windowed saucer. Had rectangular windows in a cabin that was above what you might say were two inverted cones, like the typical saucer photographs you see. Only it had a flat roof. There was an illumination on the inside. The door is very long, and just to kind of speed it up here a little bit, eventually we heard the voice, but we went back to the playground, and the saucer showed up again, hovered above us, and we heard a voice and said about five of us would be taken aboard, but not be afraid because they could make us forget the experience if that's what we wanted. And they said a needle would be placed in our lower abdomens for some reason. And of course, I was frightened at that. And to make a long story short, I remember at least three others went up and came back, and then it was my turn, and I was terrified. But there was a guide, what appeared to be a human male guide, that took me by the arm, and we levitated above the trees, and he wanted me to get used to it and was very considerate.
I was just intrigued by the human male guide. Human. You mean like us?
Yeah, but they were very good at using screen images, you might say. Okay? So it might have been human, and it might have been something else also, and it might have been not human. At any rate, we didn't rise on up to the craft, but we floated to the other end of the playground and down near the ground, and I witnessed what seemed to be a ceremony of some kind. And I now know that it was very similar to a Masonic ceremony. At that point, I was encouraged to join the Boys Demolite, or the Boys Auxiliary Organization, which is the Demolites of the Masons. They were finally ready, I guess, for me to enter the craft. And when we entered the door on the bottom, and there was actually a small ramp. And as we went up the ramp, there was what seemed to be a small lizard or alligator-like creature that stopped me. And he asked me questions, but my guide, the fellow who was with me, gave the answers, not I. And this happened about three times. And I know now that after 25 years of study, that this was very similar to the ceremonies of the ancient Egyptian religion where the pharaohs were taken to the other world from their celestial boats and so forth. They would go up a ramp and they would have somebody, the gatekeeper, that would ask them questions, and the guide, not them, would give the answer. I was shown the little lizard, about four or five of them, and I was told that they were in charge of my lifelong education and development, and that freaked me out, of course, because I thought I was only responsible to my parents. Eventually, I was put on the examination table, and they examined my legs and told me I would have trouble with varicose veins in my later years, and that I would have heart surgery, or heart attacks and heart surgery. And as a matter of fact, I would have more than one heart attack and more than one heart surgery. And anyway, they sort of chewed me out for not cooperating. And I had been getting into trouble with some of my buddies, you know, at 13 years old. And they chewed me out for that and told me I would treat others more kindly from now on, and that I would treat my parents more kindly because they knew what I did.
That probably blew your mind, that yes. They knew what you did?
Still does, as a matter of fact. At any rate, I came down out of the saucer, and there were two time loss periods in this overall encounter, which, of course, became a time loss experience. At any rate, there were several other things happen. One thing is, just before the saucer left the area, I saw it stop a car on the boulevard, and the lights went out, and the car couldn't move or was stopped as it was hovering over it.
This was without hypnotic. This was without any hypnotic regression. This was on your own.
Yeah, and it developed over a period of a few months, like 3 to 4 months.
And so, John, when all of that began to pour out from your unconscious mind, tell us how that affected you in your life.
Well, I didn't handle it real well at first, especially the levitation to the craft and that series of events. It felt as I didn't have a choice, although they didn't take me until I agreed to go. But it was like I felt I had been raped. You know, I imagine it's like feeling that somebody has really abused you. And yeah, right. And I would break out. I was 48 years old, and I would break down in tears. And it was, you know, it was really tough.
And at that time, did you seek counseling or help for this?
No, I didn't. I didn't trust. Well, yeah, I guess I did. I did, and then I didn't trust anybody. I called every psychiatrist in Lincoln and to see, you know, I knew it was real, but I had to verify that it was real. And none of them were sympathetic to the idea that UFOs were real. So I figured it would be a risk for me to, you know, I would lose my job, you know.
I think most of us would have the same reaction. What happened to you after these this initial memory surfaced? And then before we go on with, before we end tonight's show, I want to hear another couple of your stories. But let's just kind of go into now how you adjusted.
Okay, well, I didn't adjust too well. There were several things happened. Annie and I decided we'd take a trip and get away from it, and we went to... we had friends in near the Tetons in Dubois, Wyoming, and so we headed out that direction. A side note here just for listeners to remember is that we camped at Lake Maloney at South and North Platte, Nebraska, and I got extremely angry that night for no apparent reason, and then we went on we ended up filling up with gas at Rock Springs, Wyoming, and I got extremely angry again. And then we went on to the Tetons, and I began remembering other encounters that I had had with a friend of mine who he and I went to work in around Du Bois when we were in college. And I began remembering other experiences, and I began remembering the experience with the Brilliant Light, you know, while chasing horses that one night. And I began to suspect that that was a UFO.
So a flood of sort of assorted memories were coming back, and some of these encounters you had friends and other people with you. In fact, in your book, you outline just a whole lot of stories where a lot of people are present, or certainly more than you. In fact, John, were you ever very often alone in your encounters? Would you say that the majority or maybe a large percentage of your encounters occurred when other people were with you?
Yeah, there was always someone with me, except for just a very few episodes.
And I want to mention to our Starseed listeners that as you read this book, you'll find that John has managed to corroborate his experiences with some people and has gone to great lengths after many years to get these people to come forward and to tell their stories, which is just really fascinating and really does corroborate a lot of what John says. But to go back, John, to what you're saying now, so you were telling us that you had these periods of rage while you were on a trip to sort of get away from this with your wife, and these kind of came from out of nowhere, so many contactees can identify with that, unexplained moods, and I see this in my work with them. So having said that, John, then what happened next? What did you decide to do?
Well, when we were visiting our friends in Du Bois, I began to recall other fleeting memories of seeing craft here at specific places, and I remembered what my friend and I had been doing. Now, this was in 1986, and my friend and I had worked in Du Bois in 1956 and 57. So I began remembering episodes, just brief memories of seeing craft at different specific places, and I remembered what we were doing and so forth. But I thought, I might be imagining things, so we headed back to Lincoln, and that's when I contacted, I think, the psychiatrist, and one psychologist was so sympathetic and it swallowed the whole story that I thought, you know, he wouldn't be the best guy to help me. So, yeah, right. And you have to remember, I was in research and development engineering. I was very pragmatic and did not accept things blindly.
I was just going to mention, John, that you were a very practical, analytical man, a nuts and bolts kind of guy and a scientist. And so for you to have experienced this and to have to deal with it and deal with it in the way that you have and to put your stories out there to help others is just a testament to your wonderful, beautiful soul and your incredible character. So I just want to give the audience an idea of what this very beautiful man with a very rational mind had to go through in order to come to a higher metaphysical understanding and spiritual growth through all of his experiences. Now, John, you were analyzed by two very preeminent psychotherapists in the UFO field, and one of them, Dr. Leo Sprinkel, which was a pioneering PhD, the first psychologist that I know of to study this phenomenon, and eventually studied it for so many years, who put out a wonderful book called Soul Samples, who is professor emeritus at the University of Wyoming. But anyway, he had to go beyond his own logical, scientific, psychological training to reach into the dimension of metaphysics in order to understand this phenomenon, and he helped you. Is that not right, John?
Yeah, I began to research anything that I could get my hands on, and I ran across Ruth Montgomery's book, Aliens Among Us, and Leo was in there, and I had contacted several UFO organizations who really could only tell me that UFOs, other people had experiences. That's about all the information I got. But Leo, what I read in Ruth Montgomery's book, hit the nail on the head. He explained certain things that I had recalled, and there was no possible way he could have done that unless my experiences were real, and the coincidence was just too much. So I wrote to Leo, and he wrote back, and every time he would write back, he would say something in his letter that actually exactly matched my experiences. So being an engineer in research and development, I knew that what I had experienced was real. And
sure, there was more than your logical mind could deal with. And then Dr. Fowler Jones, wasn't he at the psychiatry department at the University of Kansas, who gave, both of them gave you a stamp of approval for being completely sane?
Not normal, but sane. Leo said, it was Fowler. I said, I said, Fowler, I'm normal, I'm a typical human being. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, John, you're anything but a typical human being. And but he said I was normal and they gave me all the psychiatric tests and so forth. Yeah.
We just want the audience to know that that has been established. And, of course, all the Starseed out there, we don't need to prove that to them, but we may have new listeners that aren't that accustomed to hearing about contactee experiences or need to know more. And we just want to establish right out that John is perfectly sane. Okay.
There were many more people that were professionals that accepted my story after they got to know me and so forth. Okay.
And you had mentioned to me earlier before the program that you had some connection to John Mack. Is that true?
Yeah, John gave me a call one time and asked me to be a part of his talks to the Kansas University Med Center in Kansas City and to the University of Missouri Med Center in Kansas City. So I met him down there, and Fowler Jones was sponsoring John, I believe, at that time. And we gave a talk to both universities and then to the general public in the evening. And John pretty much accepted my story after he got to know the details.
Sure, sure. Well, those are just very excellent character references that establish the validity of your case, John. So I just kind of wanted to bring that up. It seemed like an opportune moment. So anyway, you came back and you started to seek out help and you couldn't really find any professionals that, were right. And then you found somebody you didn't feel was very objective about it, so you kept seeking. Now you can go ahead and continue with your story, John.
Yeah, well, Leo was a godsend. He possibly saved my life. And I also began to realize, I kept getting more and more memories. They just flooded back. They began to flood back. And I couldn't, they came so fast, I couldn't record the entire encounter. I would have to just write down the date and who was with me at the time. And if I had time, I would write what happened in a couple of sentences, but they came so fast sometimes that I couldn't even do that.
I want our listeners to understand this is decades of contact. You had mentioned to me at one point that, not in this interview, but earlier, that you had seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. What happened to you when you saw that film, John?
I began to weep early in the movie, and I wept and I wept. And I have to say now, it still bothers me, so there are certain things that bother me, so if I happen to weep a little bit, don't worry about it. I'm okay, but it's just still hard to handle some of it. But I did weep through the entire movie, and of course I hadn't had my recollections. I saw the movie whenever it came out. It was before 1986.
I wanted you to mention that, John, because many of our listeners have moments of realization or strange feelings or emotional reactions to things, such as popular media, movies, books. You mentioned Ruth Montgomery's book, that are indicators that there's something deep down in there that needs to come out. So that's why I wanted to mention that, and I think that that was really a profound indicator of what you were holding back at the time.
Yeah,
so
all of
this lifetime, you have tried to live a normal life all of these years, but in actuality, John, you have been a traveler between two worlds, or between worlds, let's just say.
You can put it that way, yes.
Yes, and I want to bring out how much I admire you for being able to take a stand, to hold yourself together, to experience all of these high metaphysical, deeply spiritual, profoundly agonizing experiences, and still keep 2 feet on the ground and come through it on the other side to be of service to others as they are seeking to understand what has happened to them. Because clearly the UFO phenomenon, John, has been going on since the dawn of human history. And people today in society at large are faced with so many needs for change, and the planet itself, as we know, is in some jeopardy, which we're going to get into. I'm going to get your take on that as we conduct these sessions. What you're doing is really critical to helping other people wake up, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
I don't really feel that I'm special. I feel like I'm just like anybody else, and I feel that this probably happens to many, many people, and they just don't remember. I mean, they don't realize what's happening, and we can get into that a little later if you won.
Your experiences with large crowds of people are clearly an indicator that this is ongoing with many people that aren't aware of it anymore. I just wanted to interject here for a moment that I wanted to mention to you and to the listeners that about 15 years ago, I suppose, I had a very close-up sighting of a craft. I was leaving a restaurant one night, late at night, and I had a girlfriend with me. I was going to take her home. It's on the country road. We were driving along and saw a light in the sky, and she said, I'm just going to call her for the sake of, you know, she wouldn't want her name out, so I'll just call her Susan. Said to me, she said, what is that light in the sky? That doesn't look normal. And it, sure enough, it wasn't normal. It was zigzagging and doing right angle turns, and we were most intrigued and began to follow it. Well, we followed it to the local high school parking lot. Interesting, because some of your stories, a lot of your stories, John, involve schools. But this was late at night. It was about 11 o'clock. The craft came down just above a power pole. It was immense, and we were dumbfounded. We got out of the car and went to look at it. And I don't care how many times you see this, John, wouldn't you say no matter how many times you continue to be dumbfounded every time it happens?
Yeah, and there's something mystical that happens.
Absolutely.
When you see it.
Well, just suffice it to say, the short of the story is this. I'll get to my point here in a quick second. The craft hovered there for a while. We heard the approach of helicopters, and I assumed that it was military helicopters coming on the approach. The vehicle then elevated higher above the poles and took off in a flash, instantaneously becoming a white light on the horizon. Just like that, John.
I know.
Followed by what was indeed military helicopters. Now, what's interesting about this is that about 2 days later, I stopped by the restaurant to talk to her. We were having a cup of coffee, and I said to her, I said, Susan, can you believe what happened the night before last? Do you know that she got the blankest look on her face? And she had absolutely no recollection of the incident whatsoever. That was a real indicator to me, proof positive, that people really do see these things and then block them out. So having said that, I just wanted to input that because of all of the people that you've shared experiences with that no longer had memory. So now let's go on with your story, John. I just wanted to interject that. I thought you might find that interesting.
Well, I do, and that makes us fellow travelers, and I know that you have a lot of understanding beyond the norm. At any rate, during this fall of 1986, I just began to have a flood of memory, and they came so fast I couldn't really record them all. I began to realize that I could be considered crazy if I told people about it, and so I felt I needed witnesses, people who were there that could verify my memories. And so I figured that a lot of the encounters were very subtle, and I realized that it would be difficult to remember for many people. But so I tried to remember some of the most obvious that it was just they had to remember. I mean, if it was such a blatant encounter. And so I picked one, which occurred at Chadron State Park in Nebraska, and this, again, was around 1950, and, of course, I was having my memories in 1986. And I was with a friend, and my two sisters and his sister were there that night also. And I thought he couldn't help but remember, so I called him, and he did remember the encounter, but he said, well, that was a helicopter. And actually, a young boy had told us that it was a helicopter, a craft that showed up on the lawn of the Chadron State Park at the entrance. And
I remember you talking about that in your book, where the boy did think it was a helicopter, later to be realized that's not what it was.
Yeah. Anyway, I asked this witness, I said, well, what did it look like and how did it sound? And he began to realize it wasn't a helicopter, it couldn't have been a helicopter. And he described the incident the way I remembered it. Anyway, he remembered the first and last part of that encounter, in an encounter that I estimate lasted for about 2 hours, and he couldn't remember the middle of the encounter. Anyway, I met with him later, I think it was a year or two later, and I had a stack of drawings of what I had experienced in that represented my encounters, and I just threw them out on the table, and I had to go to the restroom, and while I was in the restroom, he picked out the drawing that represented what he saw, and it was the encounter at Chatham Park. And so this was pretty much proof that the encounter took place and my memories were accurate. Except in certain ways it would have been easier if I was truly psychotic. It would have been easier to handle.
Well, in many regards, that's true, John.
Because,
and I don't have any doubt that many people who do suffer from psychoses may very well be individuals who are witnessing things in other dimensional realities that they have no context for and can't cope with it. So
the fact that you stayed stable
and solid is a real indicator, like I said, of who and what you are. Go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I think Leo Sprinkle and his partner at one time, June Parnell, actually helped several people like myself, even getting them out of institutions that they were placed in because of the stories they told out in the open, you know. So anyway, that's why people fear of telling the story. Anyway, so I guess we could go on to the January, February of 1987, and I began to put the bits and pieces together. My memories were of brief episodes, and it took me a long time to put the episodes together. And one reason it was difficult is because when the craft showed up, they showed up sometimes in a distorted atmosphere, and they would manifest in thin air. Anyway, it would be like a ghost experience in a way, but it was like being below the tops of trees in maybe even sometimes 8 to 12 foot above the ground, a craft would gradually come into view in a distorted atmosphere in a blue or gray haze, or sometimes in a dense churning fog. And sometimes there would be the craft would show up and it would float around a little bit and then it would disappear. And it would only last for a few seconds sometimes, and sometimes for a minute or more, and sometimes for, you know, there would be an encounter that would last for a couple hours or more. But I began to count the episodes, and at one time I wrote to Whitley Strieber, who I had just read his book, Dominion, I guess it was. And then later Whitley, and I had counted up to 3,000 of these episodes. And Whitley then came out and talked about a person who had claimed he had 3,000 encounters, and that was just impossible. Well, one encounter, we might have 30 manifestations in one day that lasted for seconds or a half a minute or a minute. And so it was hard to determine what actually constituted an encounter. And we can get, if we have a lot of time, we can get into why that happens and so forth. But I think if you see the photographs of some of the UFOs, you'll see a distorted atmosphere around it. The air is unstable. Anyway, I discovered that I had time traveled with what I call familiar strangers. They were people who I didn't know, but they seemed very, very, very familiar. And a craft would show up, and they would be on board, and we would often hear a voice that would resound inside our heads, or we would hear it audibly that would come from the craft, or sometimes from midair. Well, during these, at the beginning of the time travels, the voice would coax myself and whoever was with me on board, and then we would, and the familiar strangers would be on board. And we would fly off into the future, and we would stop at different times and locations along the way, and we would arrive at a certain time and location, and we were shown what we were to do in the future at a specific location. And I'll get into what my assignment was, so to speak. At any rate, during January and February, I also recalled one last encounter that I had, and it happened to be in August of 1986. And it was during that trip to the Tetons and to Du Bois, Wyoming, at Maloney Lake, south of North Platte, Nebraska, when I got so angry. And I won't describe the encounter in extreme detail, but basically the craft showed up. I got extremely angry, and we were setting up camp. After we got it set up, the craft started floating through the trees, and I heard the voice, and he asked me why I was so angry, and I said it was because I couldn't remember the encounters, and it was ruining my more normal life. And he told me, and it was a rich male voice, by the way, who spoke in perfect English. He told me that they didn't want me to remember, that if I remembered, it would negate the purpose of the encounters. And they wanted me to continue as we were and not remember. But I had a choice, and my choice would be final, and I had to make a choice there and then, either to continue and not remember, or to remember and not continue the what I call the overt encounters or the complex encounters.
Wow, so he gave you a choice to ease your suffering or continue on with their program.
It was there and then I had to choose. And he said if I chose not to continue and to remember, that I would meet the people who I would be involved with in the future, and they could possibly help me develop my, what we would call metaphysical or spiritual talents and abilities, in order that I could carry out the task for which I had been trained and educated my entire life. And I don't remember choosing, but to make a lengthy story short, I saw the people in a future episode, and I remember thinking to myself, well, I don't have to continue, and I don't have to meet those people, and I don't have to participate at all, no matter what he said. You know, it was stubborn, in other words. And anyway, the encounter ended, and we took off. And anyway, we took another short trip after that and went to Niobrara State Park. I remembered another encounter.
Were there any outside of the state of Nebraska?
Oh, yeah. They ranged, all the encounters in total ranged from coast to coast and from Canada to Mexico. Well, in the spring, early spring of 1987, my daughter told some friends about my encounters. They let me know that the fellow Shirley MacLaine mentioned in her book, Out on a Limb, going to speak at Peony Park in Omaha. And so they wanted me to come up and listen to it, and maybe it would help me with handling my encounters. So I met him up there, and I started recognizing people around me, the lady sitting beside me, the lady ahead of me, fellows and gals sitting beside the stage at the front, who seemed to be the hosts of the talk.
Anyway, John, you when it gets right down to it, as far as processing all of this information, what I think it's important for the listeners to know is that you really did go through a period of intense personal struggle, spiritual crises, emotional crises, family crises, just really turned your life upside down, as one would expect would happen to a human being that's really confronting and dealing with an alternate reality. Things and events, beings, circumstances, knowledge that completely goes against the paradigm of typical human belief. And that is the thing that you not only survived these experiences, which people will have to read your book to understand really how that wreaked havoc in your life, but you have become a much wiser person. You have a cosmic perspective on things. There's just wonderful things that we have to talk about in our upcoming episodes about some of the things that you learned, some of the things that they talk to you about. I wanted to say to you, John, that I find it interesting. Now, let me back up just a moment, please. Listeners don't realize, and I didn't ask you about your father and your mother, and in your book, you have indicated interesting facts about your parents. Your dad was a manager or a park ranger for the Nebraska State Parks. Is that right?
Well, he basically was the chief of the state fisheries most of his entire life.
And that's one reason that you all spent so much time out in the woods.
Yes.
You camped a lot, where a lot of these occurrences occurred.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that you mentioned that this happened in isolated areas. And some of your situations that I read about in the book, approaching the lights through the tree line, or the lights approaching you through the tree line, brilliant lights. Were some of them golden, John? Were they yellow?
Well, primarily what I remember is a white light.
I myself, having grown up in wilderness areas and having sightings on logging roads, I think it's interesting that a lot of these occurrences happen in remote wilderness areas. What do you think about that, John? Do you think that's valid?
Well, they do, but I think there's a reason for that. But also they took place in crowded cities. We had one really strange encounter at a Nebraska football game. I had another encounter at a high school football game. And then I saw craft at other times at athletic events where there are hundreds of people around, but they appeared very subtly, you might say, at one end of the field or the other end at certain opportune times.
Can you tell us about one of those briefly?
Yeah, I read about the time at the Nebraska football game, and there were thousands of people there. And Annie and I were sitting about halfway up in the south stands, and we noticed the crowd over to our left in the corner of the stadium began to roar, and there wasn't anything to cheer about. And so we looked over there, and we saw volumes of fog, what seemed like fog, began to develop. And one of the little discs with the headlights, there were a flight of discs that four or five that showed up sometimes, and they had two headlights, and the headlights would irradiate the atmosphere. It wasn't like a spotlight. Anyway, one of these showed up above the crowd in the corner of the stadium, and people were pointing at it, and it started to float off in our direction just in front of us, and it passed right in front of us. After it got by, it turned and went up the stadium above every 10 feet above everybody's heads, and it went over the top of the stadium.
That's just amazing, John. I want to take a moment here. I want to mention your website again and where people can get your books. I think that I need to tell them about this so that they can go get their own copy and read about these fascinating experiences in detail. The books are Imminent Discovery to Earth from Heaven, and they can be purchased at fosterufos.com. He's telling us one of the many stories in his book. Yes, John?
Or Amazon.com.
One of the things, John, that I found to be so fascinating and unusual about your case, or rather your experiences, was the nature of the craft. In your book, you describe small craft, like the little lights or globes or whatever you want to call them that appeared in the school hallway. And then I want you to tell us about that. But then there were also descriptions about a bell and coffins, and boxes and booths and teepees and tubs. Can you give us a little overview? I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about the globes that appeared in the school hallway?
Actually, they weren't globes. They were craft. They were small craft. Yes. They, of course, they manifested from the distorted atmosphere, and they were very small. They were like a foot across, or a foot and a half in diameter. And anyway, high school boys, they try to show everybody how tough they are and so forth and smart. And anyway, there were some of us just kind of raising Cain on the third floor. And these things showed up. And one thing we can talk about a little later is that when the craft showed up, especially men, sometimes went a little crazy. They would get extremely excited. And two friends of mine saw the craft, and they got extremely excited. And they started chasing the craft, and the craft swooped down the stairs, and of course there were two flights of stairs for three floors, and the students that were coming up and down got out of the way, and we ended up on the first floor, and the principal came running up asking who was causing trouble, and of course the craft then dissipated into the atmosphere by that time. And one of my friends who had been before remembered that he had seen the craft when he was with me, and he said, the principal asked us to, whatever's happening, take it outside. And this friend said, yeah, John, why don't you take your friends outside, which he had done a couple of other times. So I was pegged several times in my life of being responsible for the appearance of the craft.
Now that brings up another subject matter of interest to our audience, John, and that is being unusual, being perceived as unusual, feeling a bit different. Tell us about that when you were young.
Well,
how did this affect your identity growing up?
I don't know. Really, I still struggle with that, you know, and I struggle with some of my old high school buddies, their relationship and so forth. I developed thanks to my grandparents and my parents, I have a extreme, I hold very dear, the quality of kindness. I feel that if somebody is kind, they have my full attention. They'll do anything for them. So I had an extreme, try to be kind to everybody, and I have a deep feeling of love, I guess you might say, for people. But people are cruel, and sometimes, you know, that hurt. And especially when I didn't deserve it. I did deserve it sometimes because, you know, I teased my sisters unmercifully, for instance. But
well, when
I
it comes to your encounter experiences, though, people
what
persecute
do you mean, now?
People persecute those that they perceive as
different. Oh, yeah. I have one uncle especially that really abused me because...
Were they from a religious background, John?
No, not necessarily. I'm just a typical American Christian family. But he would almost go crazy every time the craft would show up, and he knew somehow that I was responsible. And a few times he would actually grab me and shake me, or he didn't hit me, but the craft would show up, and the voice would start speaking to him, and he would let me go. And there was one time I worked for him on the farm, and the craft showed up one night in the parking area or the barnyard and shooed him out and threatened to take me right there, and so forth.
So you would say these beings at times were your advocates and at other times they were critical?
Yeah. They were what?
Critical sometimes.
Actually, they were more in a...
Encouraging you to do better.
In a teaching way, yeah.
Yes,
One time at a University of Nebraska basketball tourney at the University of Nebraska Coliseum, I write about this in Chapter 5, I believe, of Tourist from Heaven. A friend of mine and I were lured down into a dark area beside the Coliseum, and there were a group of boys that were just going to beat us up for the thrill of it. And the saucer showed up, and the voice began to threaten the boys. And while he had them cornered, or the saucer and the voice had the boys cornered, my friend and I escaped and got away. And then there were other times when they sort of protected me.
Which brings to mind the idea of aliens and angels, or the supernatural protective qualities that were extended to you that some people would attribute in earlier times perhaps to angelic intervention?
Actually, I write a little bit about that, maybe a lot about it. The phenomenon, plural, that I encountered is described almost perfectly in the Bible from Genesis through Revelations. So I made the connection that this actually has happened throughout the ages, and that what happened as described in the Bible is probably more real and correct than not.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you mention a particular particular closeness or affinity with Archangel Michael.
Actually, one of the most important parts of the books is Chapter 9 of Imminent Discovery, and it was an encounter that lasted from just after supper until well after dawn the next morning, and it was the encounter where they told us who they were and what they were doing in some detail. Do you want me to go into that now? Or?
Well, that's where we need to pick up our next program, John.
Okay.
Because next week I want to talk to you about all of that.
Okay.
And we want to talk about Egypt and some time travel, and we want to talk about the praying mantis beings and the alligator beings and the Egyptian alligator god, and I want to talk to you about passing through walls and what all of this has to do with Masons and Mormons, and I want to talk to you about the hierarchy. So we're going to enjoy this together next week. And I want to thank you so very much for being here with us at Starseed Radio Academy, John Foster. And I can't wait for next week's interview. You have a wonderful evening and be blessed. We'll talk again next week.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Welcome, John. And for those of you out there who feel so compelled, I'm going to again remind you to go to fosterufos.com for copies of his wonderful books that detail these incredible experiences that may be very helpful to you in your personal journeys. The first is called Imminent Discovery by John Foster, and then there is a companion book to that is a collection of his drawings, his wonderful art about his experiences. And then the second book, To Earth from Heaven, which he recommends that you read after you read the first book. So those can be found on his website at fosterufos.com. Again, Starseed audience, this is Anastasia. It's been a privilege to be with you tonight, and we'll talk again next week.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.